This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Though the attacks of September the 11th and the war on terrorism have touched the lives of almost everyone, maybe no single group has been more affected than Arab Americans. They suffered the shock of this tragedy, like everybody else. They've also had to adjust to living under suspicion. Many third and fourth generation Arab Americans say they're alarmed that their patriotism and loyalty is being questioned. More recent arrivals are disappointed to find America a less welcoming place than they had hoped. While many people have reached out to Arab Americans in various ways, they have to live with wary glances, real and perceived, and with the increased scrutiny of the government. As a war with Iraq appears all but certain, many in Arab American communities see both danger and opportunity, the danger of being marginalized by those who fear and misunderstand them, and the opportunity to share their experiences with a suddenly attentive public. This hour, we want to hear what Arab Americans have to tell us. A little bit later in the program, we'll talk with a former French diplomat about the deepening rift between France and the United States. With us right now here in Studio 3A is Hussein Ibish, Communications Director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much.
We'd also like to hear from you. If you are an Arab American, how has your American experience changed since 9/11? Are you worried about what might happen over the next few weeks? If you're not part of that community, have your feelings about Arab American neighbors and friends changed over the past year and a half? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And Mr. Ibish, first of all, we say Arab American, this is a very diverse community.
That's right. Arab Americans have origins in 22 Arab states across North Africa and the Middle East. There are, we guess, around 3 million Arab Americans, probably split roughly in half between Muslims and Christians, though we're not sure because the Census Bureau has never asked people whether they are Arabs or not. So we've been kind of urging them to do that for over a decade, but they haven't. And I'd like to begin by making a distinction clear, for the listeners, between the Arab American and the American Muslim communities. These are overlapping communities, but they're not synonymous. So Arab Americans are Americans with their origins in Arab states, and Muslims, Christians, certainly some Jews as well, and others who come from those countries. American Muslims come from all over the world, and at least a third of them are African American converts to Islam, they are a religious group as opposed to an ethnic group. So you could think in terms of Latin America, where Latin Americans are brought together by a shared culture, a shared history, a shared language, as Arabs are, but it's not an ethnic it's not a racial group, and it's not a religious group as such. And that while most Latin Americans are Catholic, most Catholics are not Latin Americans because the Catholic umbrella mm-hmm. goes much beyond. It's the same thing with Islam. Most Arabs are Muslims, many of them are not, but most Muslims are not Arabs. The largest Muslim countries are Indonesia, India, Pakistan, etc. So it's less confusing than people think it is. One is an ethnic group, the other is a religious group. That's it.
Talk to us, though, about the what may have been a common experience of this community after 9/11.
Yes, I think it was a common experience, and particularly one that really brought the Arab American community together. As you said in your outstanding introduction, there was the shock and horror and the same reaction that all Americans felt, but then certainly there was a kind of backlash that was experienced by the community. First of all, in terms of a real surge in violence, hate crimes directed against Arab Americans, Muslims, and other people of color who were, I guess, mistaken, especially Sikhs. Sikh men who, in their traditional dress, wear turbans and have beards, etc., interestingly and I think suggestively, often mistaken for Arabs or Muslims and subjected to horrible violence, including murders. There were about 700 incidents, violent incidents directed at Arab Americans or those perceived to be Arab Americans in the first 9 weeks following the attacks. But I'm glad to say that after the 9 week mark or so, the rate declined rapidly. And although we're still at higher rates than we have seen over the past decade, it's not dramatically so. I think the intervention of people like the president and many other leaders, people in Congress, lots of prominent Americans across the board, calling for tolerance had helped a great deal. And I think that while the situation was quite bad, it certainly could have been much worse. And at the same time, we've had this increase in violence, in discrimination, employment discrimination, and other forms of discrimination, which are generally speaking running at rates of about fourfold what we've seen over the past 10 years. So quite a considerable increase that is continuing. We've still seen a tremendous number of efforts to reach out with voices of compassion, of reassurance, et cetera, and to really express the sentiment of the big majority of the American people that they want this country to remain a tolerant, multicultural, multi-religious country which does not engage in discrimination and does not engage in collective guilt.
Yeah. Still, though the incidents of violence have diminished and discrimination too, feeling like people are looking at you differently,
right.
That has to be... I can't imagine it.
Well, it's very tough. And this is really exacerbated greatly by the cultural climate in the country today. I'd like to say that the long-term effects of the post-September 11th environment are really most dramatically felt in two ways. Certainly, there is a real problem of civil liberties and civil rights. And that especially focuses on foreign nationals, Arabs, Muslims who are not citizens of the United States, maybe green card holders or people on various kind of visas, who are now subjected to discriminatory scrutiny based on national origin, things like alien registration, selective alien registration based on the country where you're from, or other types of intensive scrutiny, thousands of interviews of young men, and, kind of reintroduction, in effect, into our immigration policies and immigration law enforcement system of national origin discrimination for the first time in many decades. But I think that those kind of concerns generally have been restricted to foreign nationals living in the United States, not to Arab citizens, U.S. citizens of Arab heritage or Arab ethnicity. I think that for Arab Americans as such, the biggest problem actually is the cultural climate, which we were referring to a moment ago, is the fact that these days, if you just turn on your television, open a newspaper, listen to the radio, there's a very good chance that you will encounter some form of expression that stigmatizes your community, that casts a question on your loyalty, that implies that Islam is a religion of hatred, or which, generally speaking, creates a climate of fear and hostility. And I think that the kind of cultural climate that has emerged where those sorts of expressions, even very hateful, very vicious attacks on, let's say, the religion of Islam or the character of the Prophet Muhammad or the nature of the Quran, launched by otherwise well-known and respectable people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and Franklin Graham, or people from other communities like the commentator Daniel Pipes, the ubiquitous television commentator, actually come very close to an experience that I would describe as anti-Semitism light. It's not, I think, as onerous as the challenge facing American Jews in the teens and 20s because of anti-discrimination laws and because of the progress the country has made through the civil rights movement and other forms of social maturation. But there is still this argument out there in the mainstream press, in the mainstream of our culture, not on fringe websites, but in the mainstream, that suggests that the Arab Americans and American Muslims may look like nice people, but in fact they are an alien community that who have values that are antithetical to our own and who worship a hostile and alien God and who are here not to live and have a happy life, but to subvert and undermine our white Christian or now Judeo-Christian civilization, and they need to be regarded as a threat. Mm-hmm. That idea is out there in our culture right now.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email address is totn@npr.org. Our first caller is Abdul, who joins us from Cary, North Carolina.
Yes, Mr. O'Neill?
Yes.
A pleasure to be on your show, sir.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I'm calling from Cary, North Carolina. I know you said that, but do you want my opinion?
Yes. Tell us about what your experience is. I take it from your name that you're an Arab American, or at least of Arab origin. Tell us what it's been like for you.
It's been lovely, like always. You know, we all in America, and this is what we dreamed of before we come mm-hmm. here. And I mean, tragedy happened, and we felt the pain of it. You know, I mean. We all feel the pain, but, people's attitude is still the same.
Were you treated differently after 9/11, do you think?
No, sir. No, mm-hmm. sir. If you want to look at it, you can make that happen. If you want to look at it differently, then it's going to turn out to you to be different. Hmm. If you look at things in a nice way, it's going to be a nice, you know.
Mm-hmm. Am I hearing your family there behind you?
Yes, sir. My wife and my children.
How many kids you have?
I have 3 kids, sir.
And how old are they?
7 and 9 and 18 months.
So you've got your hands full.
Yes, sir.
I love them.
Thanks very much, Abdul, and thanks very much for the call.
And one last thing. God bless America, and trust me, Mr. O'Neill, it's been lovely. It's been wonderful, you know. We haven't seen any changes, and America should stay, you know.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think that really was quite a representative call in many ways, in the sense that, what should be stressed, I think, is that certainly in this difficult climate, most Arab Americans had not been abused, most have not been discriminated against, most have not suffered in any way. The problem is that most people, almost everyone, does know someone who has. So that is where the anxiety comes from. It is not that people find that, you know, America is no longer a great place to live, as the caller said. I mean, people are delighted to be here, delighted to live here. They love this country in exactly the terms he described. At the same time, though, I think many people in the community, most people, do feel exposed and vulnerable because they know somebody who has had some kind of problems.
Well, let's hear from Pamela. And Pamela's on the line in Tallahassee, Florida.
Yes, sir. Unfortunately, I don't have such a happy story as the last caller, but I'm a second-generation Arab American. Both sets of my maternal and paternal grandparents came from Syria through Ellis Island, which I'm very proud of. On 9/11, I watched the story in the morning and all day, and I went to work at 5 o'clock that afternoon. I'm a bartender in Tallahassee, and I was upset just like all of my patrons. And most of these patrons are 20-year patrons and friends. Well, one of them just, I guess, you know, the hatred of watching it on the television came up to me and stormed me and said, and see, I don't deny my heritage. He who denies his heritage has no heritage. And I've always, you know, told people I'm Arab American and proud of it. He came up to me and told me that we need to kill you, your mother, your father, and all your family. Like, you know, we were the ones responsible. I was born and raised in Miami and grew up, and I love this country more than anything. And to add to that, when I got off of work and came home that night, my home was robbed and ransacked.
Hmm. Yeah, that's the other side of the coin.
Yes, and I feel so sorry. You know, and I have flags and patriotic things and everything all over. And I love my heritage and I love my country. But, you know, it was just taken out on me for an unjustified reason.
Has that eased up in the last year?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Oh, believe me, the guy that came up to me was jumped on immediately by the rest of my customers, and he was sorry he said that. But it's you know, like I said, it was in the hatred of the moment, you know.
Yeah.
Just you blurt things out without thinking. And he was very sorry afterwards. As far as who robbed my house and everything, it wasn't a coincidence. It was done on 9/11.
Well, Pamela, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate
it. Thank you, sir.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
We're talking about the Arab American experience. More of your calls after a break. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later on in this hour, we'll be speaking about the vigorous French resistance to American policy in Iraq and the addition of Liberty Toast to the breakfast menu on Capitol Hill. But now we're talking about the Arab American community, how they're experiencing our country's heightened concerns about terrorism. Here with us in Studio 3A is Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. And we have an email question from Andy in Ann Arbor. I remember, he writes, a lot of anti-Arab sentiment during the oil crisis of the 1970s. There were many acts of anti-Arab violence at that time. Has the violence been more or less severe than it was in the 1970s?
Well, actually, it's very interesting because it was precisely that period of 1973 to 1980 which culminated with what is known as the Abscam scandal, in mm-hmm. which the FBI dressed up Italian-American agents to pretend to be sheikhs from the Persian Gulf to bribe congressmen, some of whom took the bribes and were then convicted.
Yeah, it worked.
It worked. The question was, you know, why create an ethnic stereotype when there was no instance on record of Arabs actually bribing American congressmen? You know, there was a real climate of hostility and of this stereotype, particularly the oil sheikh. And it was that whole experience that led to the creation of the organization that I represent, of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, founded by former Senator Jim Abaresque. So actually, we don't really have good data on the violence that happened between 73 and 80. But I think it's very clear that the violence after the September 11th attacks, particularly in the first 9 weeks, was completely unprecedented. And I do think we still live in a period of heightened tension and heightened violence, although certainly it's restricted to a very small minority of Americans.
Joining us now on the phone is Nasser Beydoun, Executive Director of the American Arab Chamber of Commerce in Dearborn, Michigan, one of the nation's most established Arab-American communities, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
There's a longstanding Arab-American community in Michigan. Tell us a little bit about it. How old is it?
Well, the immigration from the Arab world to Michigan started in the late 1800s, and the community has been here since then. We've been part of Michigan for about 100 years now.
How have people there been affected by the war on terrorism and the aftermath of 9/11?
I think our community has fared a little better than the rest of the Arab American communities throughout because it's an old and large community. We have about 400,000 Arab Americans who reside in the Metro Detroit area in Michigan, making it the largest concentration of Arab Americans outside the Middle East.
Mm. You work for the Chamber of Commerce. Are businesses, cultural institutions concerned that they've been singled out?
Yeah, we're very concerned about some of the actions and being perpetrated by the Justice Department against the Arab Americans and about Arabs in general. Well, we find them to be very worrisome.
What particularly concerns you?
Well, the singling out of Arabs and Muslims at airports, when the government goes after people who have extended their visas, they target Arabs only. And actions like that, point that the Arab-American community is suspect in some way.
Suspect in some way, yet inevitably you come back to the question. The hijackers came mostly from Saudi Arabia. There have been arrests, few convictions as of yet, but arrests of people, Arabs at least, are in this country on charges. There is a very small percentage of people who have been involved in terrorism.
Correct. And but you have to remember that the hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. The hijackers were not Arab American. They were not immigrants. They were here from a foreign country. So people have to distinguish between the Arab American community and the Arab community.
Are there concerns also about some of the charity, the fundraising? Again, there have been certainly allegations and I guess in this case some convictions of people who have been misusing those funds.
And once again, the government has not shown us any proof. There have been allegations, there have been raids, but yet we have not seen a conviction.
I think there have been some people who have confessed to this.
There was one fellow in Chicago who did, yeah. But there, it was a more marginal charity. I think the point here is that some of the larger charities' funds have been frozen, and people were and still are waiting for an indictment to follow. I mean, if people have done something illegal, that's what you would expect. And so it is, I think, a source of anxiety to feel that institutions can be accused and punished by seizure of asset without the benefit of due process of law.
And due process on a lot of other things have been, you know, taken away from a lot of people who have been caught in this anti-terror campaign.
How do you combat it? Is the best way to organize, use your political influence?
How do we combat it as a community, or how how's the best way that the government can combat it?
Well, I was asking about how you would combat it as a community.
We combat it just like the rest of the nation combats it. We are, you know, we consider ourselves just as American as the next person. And what threatens our nation threatens us.
Mm-hmm. No, I was actually talking not about that side of it, but how do you combat the discrimination you feel on behalf of the government from the Justice Department?
We have to be vigilant. We have to make our voices heard. We have to become politically active. We have to form alliances with other communities who have faced the same persecution from the government, such as the African-American community, the Asian community, the Hispanic community. And we just have to let the people know the reality, what the reality is.
Well, and in fact, the organization I represent, ADC, along with a number of other organizations in the community and beyond, civil liberties groups, has two lawsuits right now pending against the government regarding detentions, first asking for the government to release the names of detainees. Now, we actually won the first ruling in that case, where the government is appealing. And in another case, we have asked the Supreme Court to put limits on the government's power to spy on individuals who are not suspected of committing any crimes and go beyond law enforcement to domestic espionage. So we do get involved, actually, in the legal effort to protect the civil liberties of all Americans, I mean, not just Arab Americans.
Nasser Baydoun, before we let you go, we're facing a crisis now, and it looks like there may be a war with Iraq. Is that causing special concerns?
That's very concerning because, you know, the effects of the war and what happens during the war has a direct implication on our community, and we are going to feel the backlash if this war in Iraq doesn't go as quick as the administration thinks it might.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Nasser Baydoun is executive director of the American Arab Chamber of Commerce in Dearborn, Michigan, and he was with us by phone from his office there. Let's go now with Nate, who's on the line with us from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Yeah, good afternoon, guys. I have a position of responsibility in a local charter school and just got back from a conference where we spent a good deal of time talking about how we were going to educate our children on the issues of Islam in the Middle East. And this is really a teaching moment.
Mm-hmm.
We need, as a nation, to get beyond images of the Crusades and the conflict between Israel and Palestine for a greater appreciation of Islam that is embedded in the reality, the historical truth of Islam. Islam flows directly from Judaism and Christianity in the same way that Christianity came out of Judaism. They're all Abrahamic religions. And I think some Americans might be surprised to know that Jesus is revered in the Islamic tradition. Regularly, every day, Islam has been defamed. It is not an intolerant tradition. The whole notion of Al-Kitab, Jews and Christians are again elevated among other faiths by the Islamic tradition. It was not spread primarily by war. The spread of Islam down the coast of Africa and into Asia was spread by trade. That's where the overwhelming majority of Muslims in the world today live. It does not oppress women. If you look at the Sharia, the Hadith, and the Quran, they all have protections for the rights of women that were incredibly progressive given the period of the time.
Nate, I'd just like to break in here. I wanted to read an email we got from Michael, who writes, I'm Jewish in my 40s, and I've actually gained a greater appreciation for Arab Americans since 9/11. I really never knew anything about them before, and what I've learned since then has been almost universally been positive. So somebody who shares your experience. Thanks very much, Nate. Let's go on to another caller, and this will be Rima, who's on the line with us from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I was calling in sort of response or in follow-up to the lady whose house was robbed and ransacked.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I feel with her deeply, but, I mean, I've lived here sort of my whole life. I'm born and raised in Boston. And to me, what's been different after September 11th isn't necessarily the fact that there are, you know, random acts of racism committed against, you know, anyone, against any group, but more that the government is sort of institutionalizing that kind of racism against Arab Americans. And I'd like to hear your guest comment.
Hussein Ibish?
Yeah. I think that what has happened is that there are a set of policies that the government has produced since September 11th that are overtly discriminatory. They are almost all applicable to non-citizens, to foreign nationals in the United States. I think that what has happened with Arab Americans is we've seen a disturbing trend in terms of the way law enforcement deals with Arab Americans who are considered suspicious or who are arrested for any kind of crime, where the default to consider it a potential terrorist incident or to consider everyone as a potential terrorist is there. But actual systematic legal de jure discrimination against Arab Americans is not yet something we've passed. But I think there's a positive element to this, because I think the fact that the discrimination has been focused on Arabs living in the United States, on foreign nationals, has not stopped the Arab American community from feeling it deeply. So, in other words, there's a very positive political aspect to this unity of reaction. At the same time, I think intellectually we should be able to distinguish between systematic discrimination that is really focused on foreign nationals and the kind of different social problems that American citizens of Arab ethnicity have faced, at the same time retaining our unity and our solidarity.
Rima, have you faced anything specific since 9/11?
Little things. I'm an Arab Muslim, but I guess as an American, I look like anyone else. So it's really a matter of, if there are people who suddenly find out that I'm an Arab, they might, say something, or things that I overhear when people think that, they're among their own, whatever that means. Luckily, nothing big.
Mm-hmm. Well, the feeling, though, that though you've been here all your life, suddenly you're the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, as I was saying, sort of that feeling, I don't think that sort of isolated prejudice against Arabs in this country mm-hmm. is anything new.
Well, thanks very much, and continued good luck to you.
Sure, thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. We're speaking with Hussein Ibish, who's the communications director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. We're talking about the Arab-American experience after 9/11 and on the brink of a possible war with Iraq. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. Joining us now is Natalie Handel, a Arab-American writer and poet. Her work appeared in 110 Stories, New York Writes After September the 11th. Good of you to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
You were living in New York at the time of the attacks on the World Trade Center. How did your writing change after that day?
I don't think my writing changed after that day, but I think what we're able to publish as Arab Americans, perhaps, in that sense, publishers or journals and magazines are more willing to publish the works of Arab Americans.
So it's, in a sense, been a greater opportunity.
Yes and no. I feel definitely 9/11 has helped to eradicate the invisibility of Arab American writers. I mean, we have more than a century of Arab American literature. So in that sense, it's been wonderful, and more publishers and magazines are willing and really want to hear and see the voices and the writings of Arab American writers. But at the same time, I feel there's still a reluctance to publish. I mean, they're willing to publish, experiences of Arab Americans, but there's still a reluctance to publish, for example, poems that are about Palestine. So,
political poems.
Political poems and Palestine is in. I think the issue of Palestine is, you know, very important in among Arab American literature, just like Beirut and is an important image in the literature. So I think so. Yes, but there is an openness and there is more awareness that, you know, we Arab American writers exist and is out there in writing. So
I wanted to ask you both about a question of identity, and this we got from an email from a man named Ramzi. I have found myself, he writes, in the position of having to hold my tongue after 9/11. I removed all references to living and working in the Middle East and speaking Arabic from my resume. I now tell people I'm Greek. I've also found myself separated from the rest of the American community. I only hope that we will soon remember the ideals on which this country was founded and begin to accept our country's diversity. Natalie?
Yeah, you said he was. It's a male writer who
Ramzi. I assumed it was
Ramzi, right? Yes, I think there is a big fear among Arab American men, and I mean, justly so, with everything happening, the detainees and racial profiling. Which creates a fear. Within them. So I could understand that. At the same time, I think it's, our responsibility, our duty, not to erase, our identities, to speak out and to make aware who we are and, what we represent.
Hussein?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I would urge Ramzi, if he's listening, to be open, with people about your ethnicity, if that's your inclination. You know, one of the great challenges for Arab Americans in a moment like this is to avoid defensiveness and paranoia. And I mean that in terms of personal life, but also I mean it in terms of our analysis as well. I mean, when we create a kind of communal or collective or community strategy for dealing with some of the problems we've been talking about, it has to be based on an analysis which is sober and which does not rest on the notion the sky is falling or that the United States has become an impossible place or that the community is about to be rounded up and put into camps. So we need to have a sober and very realistic analysis of our situation, personal and collective, that, as I say, avoids defensiveness and avoids paranoia.
Natalie, I want to give you the last 30 seconds, if you would.
Yeah, just to remind them that we are American.
Right.
This America consists of all, they're not more American than we are. We are all Americans.
Natalie Handel, thanks very much for being with us. Sorry your time was so short. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Hussein Ibish is also with us. He's here in Studio 3A, Communications Director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Thanks very much for coming in today.
It's been great. Thank you.
When we come back from a short break, we'll turn from Arab-American to Franco-American relations. Why are France and the United States so far apart in their views on Iraq? Could the rift seriously breach the future relationship between our old allies? And what do you serve with Freedom Fries? Maybe some Freedom Toast? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.